Okay, start our last session here. Got some questions. All right, some of these are pretty standard questions that you get. For example, what about people who never hear about Jesus or God? What about them? Well, I believe God is just, and I believe His judgment is based on what we've been given, that we're not responsible for knowing something that we haven't been given. Romans chapter 2 suggests this, that people would be judged according to their conscience. But here's the problem. How many of these people never went against their conscience? It did not do things that they knew were wrong. All right? So I would use the analogy of gambling. I certainly wouldn't want to play that gamble. I believe, if we take this too far, well, why even bother going there? You know, if they never heard about Jesus, they're better off. Well, that can't possibly be true. All right, so if you look at that passage in Romans 2 that talks about that, the context, he's not using that to say, therefore, they're probably okay. Far from it. Basically, he's saying the Gentiles are in trouble also, but for a slightly different reason, essentially. All right, so God is judge and he's going to figure these things out. There's lots of examples. Let's say somebody's decided to become a Christian and they're driving to their baptism and they die in a car accident. What about that? I'm pretty sure God can take care of that kind of stuff, but I'm not going to give you a pronouncement. I have an opinion. I'm sure you have an opinion. Your opinion is probably the same as my opinion about that, right? But I'm just not even going to give you my opinion. God is judge. Aren't you glad that God is judge? Aren't you glad about that? It's in His hands. Our job is not to judge. Our job is to preach the truth. And as far as somebody living in Outer Mongolia, by the way, I'm hoping to visit Outer Mongolia, literally, this summer to preach, all right? So the gospel's there too. It's called Ulaanbaatar. That's kind of cool. You know, I'd been praying because I wanted to find contact with somebody there so I could go there. I show up in Korea and this couple that I'm spending time with are from Ulaanbaatar. Amen. God's in control. All right. Job 1, 6 through 12. Why is Satan having this real conversation with God? I don't know. Because God gives him permission. I mean, did God ever listen to you when you were a sinner? You know, in John 9, where it says, we know that God doesn't listen to sinners. Remember from our lesson before? That's what he said, but it's not true. God heard the prayers of Cornelius and of that centurion. So the bottom line is, you know, apparently, I mean, to some extent, this is a fable-like setting. So, you know, exactly how to interpret this whole thing, you know, I don't know. But it doesn't violate anything I know about God, that God and Satan could have, in essence, something like a conversation. All right? I'll see you soon, Wang. Good hanging out with you. Anyway, so I don't know, unless you can tell me something from the Bible that would say that God is not allowed to have this conversation, I just don't personally see that's a problem, honestly. But it's a good question. All right, I have two questions. By the way, it's Matthew 27, 51 through 52. Very good. And then there's another question about the same thing. So what happened to these people that were raised? You know, Jesus died, their graves come open. I have no idea. I do know that the bottom line is certain events are so earth-shattering, so key in God's entire plan from beginning to end, that amazing things happen in that context to say, hello, look what's happening here. All right, so the darkness that came over the land, people say that's because God didn't want to see. I guess, as if that would prevent God from seeing, to me it's more like symbolic. But also, you know, in the book, and at the day of Pentecost, so crazy. I mean, the shaking and the flames, these are just God's way of saying, hey, look, this is huge. So God chose to have these people come out of their graves as a way to say this is huge. I don't know. He picked that. I'm sure it got people's attention, didn't it? So what happened to them? I guess they went back to Hades, I assume. I don't know. It's funny, interesting question, though. All right. This question was, if we blaspheme God, would the Holy Spirit leave us? Right, that's what I said. That's the problem. And I believe that that is irreversible. All right, who did Cain and Abel marry? Not Cain and Abel. Abel didn't marry anybody. Who did Cain marry? He married probably his sister or maybe one of his nieces or second or third cousins. Ooh, creepy. Well, I don't know. Now, God said it's a sin to marry your brothers or sisters, at least in the Old Testament. It actually doesn't say that in the New Testament. You could argue that it's not a sin to marry your brother or sister. At least, you know, it's you know, I think it's a terrible idea, though. Now, why did God give that commandment? Remember we talked about from these commandments. These commandments had health implications. He did it for their own good. The fact is, if you marry out as far as your first cousin, because of the possibility of genetic disease, that can be harmful. I believe that Adam and Eve were more perfect, not spiritually, but physically. That genetically, they did not have these genetic defects that we have because of mutations. Now, I can't prove this, but I think this is a reasonable conclusion. I believe that's probably why they lived longer. It's also why to marry your brother or sister was not harmful. All right, now, how many children did Eve have? I don't know. Presumably, she was able to bear children immediately. Seems that way, or soon after. So, was it till she was 406 years old? So how many children do you think they stopped having sex? How many children do you have? I have no idea. Women are thinking, oh my goodness, imagine. You know, I don't know. Was it 30 or 50? I don't know. By the time she was 350 years old, Seth. Seth was probably a great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather by then. How many descendants were there? Now, I have absolutely no idea. But the fact that Cain went out and there were peoples, you know, if you could have 30 children in each generation, 30 squared, that's 900, 30 cubed, that's 27,000, well, that's a lot of people. So, that's my answer. Okay, let's talk about Daniel. I love teaching about Daniel. Now, I could do a sort of a exposition of Daniel and talk and get all the really great lessons from Daniel. I'm not going to do that, not because it wouldn't be a good thing, but because, again, this is a thing on Christian apologetics. So I'm only going to take on that part of Daniel, which is relevant to showing the Bible's inspired by God. And for me personally, Daniel is my favorite book for making it so blatantly obvious that the Bible is inspired. It's those visions of Daniel. So I'm going to say just a couple of very quick things about the book in general, because it kind of sets the stage for the visions. Okay? I forgot this was here. Here's a reminder about our apologetic certificate program. I've got some information here if you want. Some of you might want to consider that. If you would do it in a group, we would lower the price. Okay? So you buy one copy, and then each additional student would be significantly less. Anyway, think about it. All right. Apparently I wrote a book on Daniel. All right, great. Now the theme of Daniel is God rules the nations. Do not fear. There are two main messages of Daniel as I see it. Basically, message number one is stay righteous. Live righteously in a world that is very corrupted. The other one is God's in control, and please live as if you believe that God's in control. Now, of course, officially we all agree that God's in control. By the way, that doesn't mean His will is always done, right? You know, because there's people that don't obey God. But, you know, God is in control in the bigger sense. In the sense of all things work out for the good of those who love God and call according to His purpose. So the question is, do you really live? Does your life say that you believe God's in control? So that's one of the messages of Daniel. The other one is sort of the practical message about how we as believers, as disciples of Jesus, can live a righteous life in a world which is doing everything to cut that down. And now, of those two messages, what we're going to look at today primarily is going to help us out with the second message, not the first. That's kind of the nature of Daniel. All right? The audience of Daniel is the Jews in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in the years 167 to 164 BC as they're suffering extreme persecution. I forgot to get my notes. Now you might be saying, well, who's he? Which book in the Bible do you hear about Antiochus Epiphanes? The answer is in 1 Maccabees. You say, I never read 1 Maccabees. Well, you should. It's a great book. Now, I don't know if it's inspired. Like I said, of the books in the Apocrypha, the one that's in there that I could be convinced possibly might even actually be inspired, it's just me. I mean, this is my opinion. It's 1 Maccabees. It's a pretty awesome book. And 1 and 2 Maccabees both describe the series of events that are the events that shows the primary audience. Now, if you want to think about Daniel in the Old Testament is the equivalent in the Old Testament of Revelation in the New Testament. Their themes are almost the same, and their scope is very similar. Okay? The principal audience of Revelation is the Christians receiving extreme persecutions under Domitian and the Roman kings that came immediately after Domitian. Now, all of us can learn a lot from Revelation, obviously, but that's the audience of the book. And when you study hermeneutics, it's good to know who the audience is. All right? And similarly, Daniel's written to a very persecuted people. The message in both cases is God is in control. Although it may not seem that way, God is in control even in this very difficult situation. Hey, got it? Now, the brief outline of Daniel is this. Chapter 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego under very difficult circumstances giving glory to God in every circumstance. Why? Clear. Because they believe that God is in control, that God rules the nations. Alright? So there's the fiery furnace. There's the lion's den and all these things. Now, we're not going to study those chapters. We're just not going to do it because although that's great, it's not relevant to what we're doing here in this class. Okay? The other part of Daniel is chapters 2 and 7 through 12. These are the visions of Daniel and the dreams that he interprets. Now, there is one dream in chapter 4, but just to keep it simple, we're not going to even cover that dream. All right, now, Daniel is a genre of literature for which there is literally only one book in that genre. It's a history book of the future. If you were to go into your library and ask, where is your section of books that reliably and without mistake tell the future? They would laugh at you. So Daniel is unique. Now, for those who want to undermine the reliability, the idea of inspiration of the Bible, those who really know what they're doing understand that Daniel is a key book here. All right? A lot of them go after Daniel because I'm telling you, man, those prophecies, man, they're amazing. And so what these people do is they try to say that Daniel was written after the events of 167 through 164 BC. That's what they say. But that doesn't make sense for so many reasons. All right? First of all, remember I talked about the Septuagint translation of the entire Old Testament, which was made around 250 BC, certainly completed by 200 BC. So that seems to imply that Daniel is translated into Greek as part of the canon of the Old Testament in 200 BC, which means it probably was not written after 164 BC. Now, I admit I can't absolutely prove that, but there's no evidence in the reverse, and there's plenty of evidence in that favor. Also, Daniel, at least parts of it, are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, that particular little piece of data, it's not large, is from around, I believe it's around 100 BC, or 125, 100 BC. So I admit that is after 164 BC. But what that means is Daniel existed as part of the canon of the Old Testament. All right? And so accepted, it was found everywhere, because to have one found there in Qumran says it must have been everywhere. So what we're saying is, because according to these critics, that whoever wrote Daniel is just a liar. A liar. Claiming to have been there and witnessed these events and recorded them faithfully. So they're thinking that these Jewish leaders were so stupid and so ignorant and so gullible to put the book of Daniel into their canon, you know, when it had only been written for about 20 or 30, you know, years. This idea really defies, you know, common sense. And they'll say, well, the Aramaic in the book of Daniel is a later kind of Aramaic, which is simply not true. Experts in the Aramaic religion will tell you. By the way, religion. By the way, almost half of Daniel is in Aramaic, not Hebrew. I don't know if you knew that. And those who are the experts tell us that the Aramaic in Daniel is of the Eastern kind. In other words, not the Western kind the Jews spoke. From around 400 BC, more or less, plus or minus 100 years. They'll say, well, there are Greek words in Daniel. Proof that the Greeks had already conquered Babylon. Not true. What is the word for piano in Tagalog? Good. What's the word for guitar in Tagalog? Right. So what's one of the very, very, very first words incorporated into a language when you begin to interact with another culture? Well, the words for their musical instruments, obviously, because you don't even have a word for that thing. And the only Greek words in Daniel are those musical instruments in Daniel chapter 3. In fact, that's actually evidence for only minor interaction with the Greeks, not that they've been conquered by the Greeks, in which case there would have been other loan words. Are there a bunch of loan words from Spanish in Tagalog? Yeah. English? Yeah. So, I don't want to waste too much time on this, but the bottom line is this. We can say with excellent confidence that Daniel was certainly written by 400 BC. And the only reason anybody believes differently is because they already assume that the Bible's not inspired. Now, if the Bible's not inspired, then how do you explain the prophecies, especially in Daniel 11? Even the most committed skeptic agrees that those happened. Well, the only possibility is that it was written after the events. So why do they believe it was written after the events? Because they believe it was written after the events and not because of the evidence. And besides that, we're going to see prophesied in Daniel things that happened in the year 96 A.D. or the year 30 A.D. And in fact, those are fulfilled with an equal precision to the ones that were fulfilled in 165 B.C. How do they deal with this? Very simply, they completely ignore it. All right, so anyway, I'm just telling you this. The book of Daniel is great stuff in terms of proving the Bible's inspired. All right, that's a quick version. Now, I have to give a little bit of historical background for these prophecies to make sense. 722 B.C. It's at my website. You can take pictures. I don't mind. But I already put the PowerPoint at my website. Evidenceforchristianity.org, and just click on the one that says, Philippine lessons or something like that. 722, Northern Kingdom destroyed. 605, Nebuchadnezzar comes to Babylon. He did not destroy the city. He did not even defeat it militarily. Basically, they surrendered. They agreed to offer tribute, and as sort of a down payment on that, the children of the royal family were taken as captives. How do I know that? Because the prophecy in Isaiah says there'll be that the children of royalty be taken as captives. All right, so they're held as ransom, essentially. You pay the tribute, or I have your children. Then 597 B.C., as I mentioned yesterday, they rebelled. He comes back. He tears down part of the wall. He sets up Zedekiah. They rebel again. He comes back in 586. He destroys the city. Now, there was a prophecy in Jeremiah, actually twice. Jeremiah, I believe it's 21 and 27, that sure enough, Jerusalem would be destroyed, and that the captivity would last for 70 years. Daniel goes into captivity in 605 or 606 B.C. So for him, 70 years means 535 or 536 B.C. Okay? Now, on the other hand, the temple was completely destroyed in 586 B.C. All right? And the temple was finished being rebuilt in 516 B.C., 70 years exactly, fulfilling that prophecy. Anyway, 538 B.C., Cyrus the Persian, who's head of the Persian-Mede Empire, destroys Babylon, not the city, but destroys the empire. And we learn about that in Daniel chapter 5, as I already mentioned. All right, great. The Persians and Medes take over. They treated the Jews relatively well, actually. Then in 334 to 332 B.C., Alexander the Great comes. He destroys the entire Persian Empire, including, of course, taking the Promised Land, obviously. He dies without having children. His wife was pregnant. When he died, four dynasties succeeded him. And then a fifth later on, as we'll see. For example, Antiochus Epiphanes ruled as one of these Greek rulers. That's the time frame there. Between 167 and 164 B.C. is this terrible persecution of the Jews that is prophesied in Daniel. In 167 B.C., the temple is desecrated, as I'll mention. And in 164 B.C., the temple is rededicated by the Maccabees, the Jews who kicked out the Greeks. Okay? Then the Greek power was finally finished off at the Battle of Actium, 31 B.C. And by the way, that battle is prophesied and described in Daniel chapter 11, interestingly. Why? Because that's the final chapter in removing the Greeks. And of course, in 63 BC, the Romans take Jerusalem. And then the fourth kingdom. The first kingdom is Babylon. The next is Persia, Persia Mede Empire. The next is the Greek Empire. And the fourth is Rome. And of course, Rome plays a major role in Daniel, even though it was a tiny, insignificant city-state when Daniel lived. So, in 6 BC, an obscure village in the Galilee region, actually, it was in Bethlehem, but the parents were from there. This person was born who kind of changed history, as you know. I could give you the rest of the details, but you probably know most of that stuff. It's the time between the Testaments that you tend to not know much about. Okay, great. So here is the Babylonian Empire. Here is the Persian Mede Empire. An unusual empire in that it was a dual empire. They kind of had dual kings, officially anyway. So it's not the Persian Empire, it's not the Median Empire, it's the Persian Mede Empire. Kind of like the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War I for you history buffs. Kind of an unusual situation. But it was a huge empire. Look at that thing. And then, of course, the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, which was the greatest empire in the world up to that time, which was, of course, succeeded by Rome, for which I don't think I have a map. I don't. Okay. Now we're going to skip Daniel chapter 1, 2, 3, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm going to get straight to Daniel 2. So let's get into that. So now we're going to look at the visions of the future. Skipping about 10 pages in my notes here. All right. Daniel chapter 2. Ready? Okay. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So he summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I've had a dream." It's kind of like Martin Luther King. Another joke. "That troubles me. I want to know what it means." The astrologer said, "Awesome. Tell us your dream, then we'll tell you the meaning." So Nebuchadnezzar, he has a dream, and it's like a religious experience. This is clearly not just a regular dream. He realizes it's a religious experience. He wakes up and he says, "Oh my gods." All right? So he needs to know the meaning, so he brings in all his court of, you know, astrologers and mystics and, you know, all these people to tell him the meaning of the dream. Now, he knows these guys are a bunch of fakes. Come on, let's be honest. They knew this is just a bunch of stuff, you know. So they say, "Great, tell us the dream first." And he's there, no, we're not going to play that game anymore. Now, this is the real thing, folks. And I need to know the answer from somebody who's the real thing. So you tell me the dream first, and then I'll tell you. And then you tell me the interpretation. Oh, not fair. You know, you expect us to work a real miracle? Not like one where they just stop limping so much and, you know, with their hand, you know, their sprained ankle feels a little bit better. You know what I'm going after here, right? All right. Yeah, in fact, I'm going to kill you. Wow. Now, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, although they were not astrologers and magicians, they were in this group of court people who would be killed. So, Daniel says there's a God in Israel who can interpret the dream. Daniel gives glory to God, not to himself. That's important. So he goes away and he comes back and he tells Nebuchadnezzar the dream. He says, "Neb, here's your dream. You saw a massive statue, head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thigh of bronze, legs of iron. But one of the legs is partly iron, partly clay, and it's brittle. And then a rock starts, it's small, it gets bigger, bigger, and it smashes that thing to pieces. And then Nebuchadnezzar says, "Oh my Jehovah!" Because that Daniel had interpreted the dream. Now let's look at the interpretation. Okay? Verse 36 of Daniel 2. "This was the dream, and now we'll interpret it to the king. Your Majesty, you are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion." So where, according to Daniel, did Nebuchadnezzar get his kingdom? From Jehovah. God rules the nations. God rules your boss who's treating you cruelly. God rules your cancer. God rules your husband who is not faithful. God rules your bank account. Even though it says zero. If God can put Nebuchadnezzar in place and can take him out, do you think he could take care of your situation if he wanted to? But maybe he doesn't want to. Remember what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said? God could save us from this flame, but even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down. See, they understood this idea. Anyway, reading on. "You are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power, might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind, the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, wherever they live, he's made you rule over them all. You are awesome. You are great." Because I'm about to give you some really bad news. "After you, another kingdom will come inferior to yours." Now, if you look at that map, was Persia inferior to Babylon? Not in terms of land that it controlled. But I would say this, Babylon was a much greater city than anything ever built by the Persians. But anyway, he's kind of buttering them up a little bit. All right. "Next, a third kingdom will come, one of bronze, that will rule over the whole earth." That is, of course, Greece under Alexander. "Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. As iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others." What ancient empire would be better described in this way than Rome? "Just as you saw that the feet and toes are partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so it will be a divided kingdom." Now, was Rome a divided kingdom? Yes. Under Diocletian, there were two capitals. And after Theodosian, there were literally two separate empires, east and west. How did Daniel know all that? That's pretty impressive. Let's read on. "As you saw the iron mixed with clay, so the people will be a mixture. They will not be remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings..." Verse 42. "As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle." So one half will be strong, one half will be brittle. Exactly. Rome officially divided in 395 BC. Western Rome fell in 476 BC. Eastern Rome endured for over 1,000 years. You know what Daniel's done? He's given us a brief outline of the history of the Near East for the next 2,000 years. That's impressive. But it's nothing compared to Daniel chapter 7 and 8, believe me. All right? Then he says, "In the time of those kings," which kings? The Roman kings, to be exact. "In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms, bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever.
This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands. Right? Not by human hands. Can you think of a kingdom that was established during Rome that's still around? In fact, that is greater than all the nations and that will endure forever? Yeah, we're all citizens of that kingdom, aren't we? Yeah, great. But Daniel 7 blows this away, I'm telling you. Let's go to Daniel 7. Now, Daniel 7 is a vision of four beasts. A lion, a bear, a leopard, and a terrible beast. Okay? Now, these four beasts are the same four kingdoms. They are Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Okay? In the first year of King Belshazzar. Now, what year is this? Turns out the year is 553 BC. This is 22 years after the first vision. I'm sorry, 52 years. Daniel is now about 70 years old. He's still doing great. Anyway, Daniel had a dream and visions passed through his mind. He's lying in his bed. In my vision, I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven, churning up the sea, four great beasts. The first was like a lion. It had the wings of an eagle. I watched it until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted up from the ground so that it stood on its two feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. That is Babylon. This is a picture from the Ishtar Gate in Babylon. Lions cover the whole gate. It was given the heart of a man, representing the fact that Nebuchadnezzar himself gave credence and faith to God. Okay, great. Next, a second beast looked like a bear, raised up on its sides. It had three ribs in its mouth. You ever see the show The Flintstones? It's kind of like that, you know. Great. It was told, get up and eat your fill. Now, that's Persia. Guess how many great empires were conquered by Persia? Three. Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. Okay, there you go. That's the three ribs. Next is a third beast. All right, it was like a leopard. It had four wings. Now, those four wings, we'll talk about that later in chapter 8. So I'm going to skip down to the fourth beast. After that vision, and I looked there before me, was a fourth beast. Terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims. It trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from the former beast. It had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came amongst them. And three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. Now imagine you're Daniel. You're thinking, I got to write this down? All right, 10 horns, a little horn. Little horn saying, blah, 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 I'm greater than you are. And he's knocking out three other horns. I mean, this is a really weird vision. When you first read this, what were you thinking? Daniel must have thought, wow, this is really weird stuff, man. I got to write this down. They're going to think I'm crazy. Of course, Daniel had no idea, but we know because we have this thing called history. Now, let's go down to the interpretation of the dream. All right, the interpretation. All right. The angel tells him, verse 20, he wanted to know the meaning of the horns and the little horn and the three that were knocked down and the speaking pridefully and the fact that it was waging war against the holy people. All right, got it? This is the explanation, verse 23. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. We know what that is. It's Rome. It will be different from the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. It'll subdue three kings. It will speak against the Most High, oppress his people, try to change the set times and the laws, the holy people will be delivered into his hands for time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit, his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever, and the sovereignty and power and the greatness of our kings under heaven will be handed over to the holy people, and they will have an enduring kingdom that lasts forever. Okay, great. So basically what he's saying is this fourth empire will have 10 kings. Now, was Rome a kingdom? No, it was not. Not for its first 700 years. It was a republic. When Daniel was alive, Rome was a tiny city-state republic in the farthest reaches of the known world. But as of 27 BC, Augustus took power, Rome became a kingdom. All right, and according to Daniel, the 11th king of Rome will speak boastfully, knock down three other horns, take out three other kings, will change, try to change the times and the laws, all right, and will attack the saints. Well, let's look at this list. Who was the first emperor of Rome to make Christianity illegal and systematically attack the church? His name is Domitian, who was, by the way, the 11th emperor. He's the little horn who spoke boastfully. Now, what's this taking out three other horns? Well, it turns out that Nero died. Nero is the last direct successor of Augustus. Now, who's going to succeed him? Well, at that time, the logical choice was Vespasian. Vespasian was the greatest general in the kingdom, but he was at Jerusalem fulfilling a prophecy in Daniel chapter 9. In the meantime, three lesser generals, their names being Galba, Otho, and Vitus, noticed the length of time they ruled for like 2 or 3 months each. They all were separately declared emperor by their troops. Vespasian marched back to Rome to take the kingdom, left behind Titus to finish fulfilling the prophecy in Daniel 9. In the meantime, his younger son, Domitian, was in Rome. And Domitian helped to defeat Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. How many times in history has one king removed three of his predecessors? That's pretty amazing. But that's what happened. Now it says he spoke boastfully. This guy Domitian was so arrogant, he demanded to be addressed by this: "My Lord God Domitian." Wow. His name was a byword for arrogance. They said, that person is a Domitian. It's like a Trump, you know? A prideful, arrogant person. I can say that because I'm an American. Now, it also says that he would change the times. Domitian was so arrogant, he said, from now on, instead of being October, it's going to be Domitianus. He literally changed the set time. Instead of November, Germanicus, which was his middle name. Imagine Duterte says it's going to be Duterte instead of September. You know, would anybody put up with that? How did Daniel know that the 11th king would be the one to attack the saints? That he would take out three other kings, and that he would change the set times and be boastful. But he also changed the laws. Rome had the greatest legal system ever. Am I supposed to end it? I thought I went to one. Oh, you're saying you have to go. Excuse me, sorry about that. Hmm? It ends at 12? Right, can I take 10 minutes? Are you sure? Seriously?
I honestly thought I had till 1, but I thought we had 4 hours today. Oh my goodness. All right, here's the quick. I could have done this much quicker. All right. It turns out that Domitian wiped out the entire Roman legal system, creating the Domitian Law. When he died, they changed the months back to October, November. They got rid of the Domitianus Law. All right? Now, this all happened in 90 AD. God rules the nations. And then there's Daniel 8. I'll have to do this as the super fast version. Daniel 8, the ram and the goat. It talks about this goat with a single horn who charges from the west, and he attacks the two-horned ram, which is Media. The ram with one horn in Daniel 8 is Alexander the Great. And it says he came from the west. Where did Alexander come from? From the west. And it says he destroyed the two-horned ram like one floating above the ground. With 30,000 troops, within 2 years, he completed and destroyed the largest empire in the world with a standing army of 200,000. And then it says, at the height of his power, his horn was cut off. And Alexander died at the age of 34. He left no children. Remember the four wings in Daniel 7? It says, it will be succeeded by four kings. There they are. After Alexander came four kings. Now, when Alexander came to Jerusalem, according to Josephus, they showed him a copy of the book Daniel and said, you are this king. And Alexander said, thank you very much. And he always treated the Jews well. All right. How many? Four. Because everything God said through Daniel happened. Then it said there will come a fifth horn out of one of them. His name was Seleucus. One of Ptolemy's generals, Seleucus, conquered part of Antigonus' kingdom. And it says he grew in power to the south, to the east, and to the beautiful land. And sure enough, Seleucus took first Mesopotamia to the south, then Persia to the east, and then he took the promised land, exactly as prophesied by Daniel. And then it says he grew great in power to reach the power of the Prince of Hosts. The stars were thrown down, and truth was thrown to the ground. And he put an end to sacrifices and offerings. That's exactly what Antiochus Epiphanes did in 167 BC, exactly as prophesied by Daniel. Why did this happen according to Daniel 8? Because of rebellion. Because of whose rebellion? Because of the Jews' rebellion. Because God's people are unfaithful, and when his people are unfaithful, he will judge them, not because he hates them, but because he loves them. And after this, the Jews had the greatest flourishing of their Judaism in all history because they were purified. And then Daniel says, how long will this last? He says 2,300 evenings and mornings, which is 1,150 days. The desolation of the temple, where he sacrificed pigs in the temple. And remember how it says he set himself up to be as great as the Prince of Hosts? Well, you don't remember, but it's in that chapter, honest. He put a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies, and the face on the statue was Antiochus Epiphanes, fulfilling in absolute detail exactly what was prophesied. But you know what? That was November 167 BC. And the temple was rededicated on December 25th, 164 BC, roughly 3 years, 1.5 months later, 1,150 days, exactly as Daniel prophesied. And then in Daniel chapter 9, as you know from our earlier lesson, he prophesied that Jesus would come to Jerusalem
and 30 AD and bring in everlasting righteousness. And then in Daniel 11, that's the big one I don't even have time for. You know the kings of the north and the kings of the south? The kings of the north are the successors of Seleucus. The kings of the south are the successors of Ptolemy. Do you know who the last successor of Ptolemy was? Cleopatra. She was the one taken out of power at the Battle of Actium, as prophesied in amazing detail in Daniel 11. But I'm now 8 minutes over time. I was given 10 minutes, so I'm going to finish up in 2 minutes. Because we have to do Daniel 12, 2 through 4. This is a great prophecy. No wonder I was making you nervous. I was going over and I looked as if I was totally unconcerned, you know. Mine too. Both of our bad. All right. Now, just like the book of Revelation, the prophecies in Revelation concern things which will, in quotes, soon take place. The prophecies of Revelation, they're not about end time. They're about the Roman Empire. However, just like Revelation fast forwards to end time at the very end, Daniel does as well. So now we're at end times. Let's see. Verse 3 and 4. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens. Verse 2. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So basically what he's saying here is at the end of time, everyone will rise. Many to shame and everlasting contempt, but others to eternal life. All right? In other words, Daniel's prophesying there will be a final resurrection. And those of us who are wise will be with God forever. We'll be like stars forever. You know what? I believe in the resurrection. You know why I believe in the resurrection? Because Daniel said that it would happen. Daniel said there would be four empires, and the fourth would be strong and weak and divided, and that the kingdom of God would be established during the time of Rome. And Daniel said it would be the 11th emperor, that he would take out three others, he would be prideful and boastful, that he would change the set times and laws. Well, that's what happened. And Daniel said the fourth kingdom, all right, that the third kingdom will have this single king who conquers the whole earth, and then who will have four successor kings, and then a fifth, and that fifth one will attack God's people, put an end to sacrifice, set up the abomination of desolation, and be taken out 1,150 days later. And he also said that the Messiah will come to Jerusalem on 30 AD, and he said it 550 years before that. So then he says that we'll be raised from the dead. You know what? I believe it. God rules the nations. The Bible is inspired by God. Thanks for putting up with me going over by 12 minutes. It's been a lot of fun. And we'll see you maybe in 2 years. That was the fastest version of that lesson ever.
Thanks, John. Thank you so much, Rob. I think we need to invite John again just to teach on Daniel.